Taylor Smurl, and I'm an experienced bartender.
And I'm Tommy Smurl. I'm an experienced drinker.
He's my dad, and together this is...
Neat! A weekly booze cast.
With history lessons, trivia, and a twist.
So pull up a stool to the bar and join us for the lowdown on your highball.
Well, usually I ask how your week's been, but I think I know what's been going on this week.
Wow, it's all about the election, all week long.
Yeah, this is a week long election. It's not a week long election. I feel like it's going to be two more months of election. Actually, now with everything that's going on right now.
Well, in a way, I guess it kind of will be kind of like the 2000 election. That one dragged out until about the middle of January or something like that.
I'm not going to feel good until Grandpa Biden is just sitting his butt in the Oval Office. Then I'll believe he won. Then I'll believe that it happened. But I don't know. I'm not going to celebrate too much.
Well, the only thing I can say is before election night, nobody in the world, I don't think, really knew who Steve Kornacki was. Now everybody knows who he is. And he's at some kind of Iron Man. He goes 36 to 48 hours at a time. No questions asked.
I know. They just plug him in sometimes. You know, it's like when you wander around with your phone too much. You're like, oh, I just got to plug it in, but I can work from the wall. Like, it's, yeah.
We all know him on a first name basis. It's like, oh, be quiet. Steve's on. Hurry, come in. Steve's back on. He's going to break it down.
I didn't get the same experience, though, because when I was visiting my family for part of the election, the first 2 days of the election night, and then I was back home, and I only have, like, internet, I don't have cable, so I could only get, like, the streaming NBC and CNN. I could not get MSNBC, which has Steve.
Oh, okay.
I was pretty sad about that, like, not to insult the other map guardians of the election, because every channel had one, but he was definitely my fave.
Yeah, me too. He did a good job breaking it down. Felt like you could trust him.
Well, and it was a very harrowing election. It looked bad for a while there. There was a slow shift in a lot of states from red to blue, and that was really lovely to see. But the people that really brought it home for us were the people of Pennsylvania. Correct?
Yeah, finally Pennsylvania made it. All five states just hung there, and it looked like some of them just kind of gave up. They didn't even give us any results for 2 or 3 days, and then Georgia and Pennsylvania just kept grinding along there, slowly but surely flipping the script. And Georgia wasn't enough to put him over the top, but Pennsylvania was.
Well, I don't mind. I'm glad they took their time. You know, I think it's going to make any sort of challenge to recount or whatever a lot cleaner, because they did take their time and they made sure everything was done correctly. But boy, oh boy, when I saw Pennsylvania go blue, and the celebration in the streets of Philadelphia, that brought tears to my eyes, I will say.
I know what you mean. Philadelphia, New York, Seattle, they were celebrating everywhere.
Yeah.
That was really something.
Well, I thought that sort of in honor of a PA, the whole nation obviously voted. The popular vote outside of the Electoral College went to Joe Biden. But because PA were the people to put us over the edge, I thought we could do a little episode talking about some of the booze related history in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, they put us over the top there. They stole the limelight. Like Florida was the center of attention in 2000, Pennsylvania put themselves in the spotlight.
I feel like a lot of those, especially like with Arizona and Nevada, I think like nobody wanted to be the state that was going to do it. But PA was like, oh, I super do. Let me get these votes in and I will be the one.
Yeah. Yeah, they didn't hesitate for a minute. They just kept trudging along and everything went from red to slowly turning blue. And then just kept growing blue.
I think as we're gonna get into, Pennsylvania has pretty important close ties with our political history here in America. So let's get into some boozy PA history.
All right, boozy PA history.
Yeah, of course, I think the first thing that comes to mind when you say boozy PA history, that's a very small category, but the standout is probably, for most people, the Whiskey Rebellion. Bled over into other states, but was really focused in western Pennsylvania.
Because they like their whiskey.
Yes, and I will say, I think in my sort of like redux version of the Whiskey Rebellion in my head up until doing research for this episode, I just kind of felt like, right, a bunch of people liked whiskey, they put a tax on it, everyone got mad and they rioted. And that's what I kind of had reduced it to. That's not really it. It's more than that. But just to kind of run through the facts, the Whiskey Rebellion has its roots in the American Revolution. Of course, if you need a reminder, we won, but we chalked up a lot of debt in the process. So in 1790, Alexander Hamilton suggested that the U.S. government take over the considerable debt incurred by individual states, and to help pay for this, issue a tax on whiskey. Now, George Washington, a newly minted president, was against this at first, but he journeyed throughout Pennsylvania and Virginia, some other states, just to sort of get citizens' opinions on this idea, and he found that local governments were, in theory, in favor of the idea. So Washington then came back and urged Congress to pass the bill. But I don't think they talked to enough distilleries or maybe gave people the specifics enough, because whatever sounded good on paper did not work in practice for individuals. And I think this is the kind of the part about it that I want to get into, because it's not just that the tax was put on whiskey, it's how the tax was enacted on individual distilleries.
And not just the distilleries, but it trickled down to individuals, and that was where the real problem came from, because it was a very regressive tax in that distilleries manufactured enough, it didn't hurt them too much, but individuals that relied on that still they had out back, right, and just ran every once in a while and used their whiskey to barter for food and stuff like that, it was very regressive for them, and it hurt them economically very much. So it was really more of an economic revolution than it was a we want to drink our whiskey revolution.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, you know, like big producers, if you could make a whole bunch of whiskey at once, you would have a very low annual tax rate, and you could have further tax breaks based on the more you produce. But these little guys, these small producers, they were effectively screwed. And like Dad said, like if you live in a community where like I trade you whiskey for a pig and I trade you whiskey for some grain, and then suddenly I have to provide cash because the tax could only be collected with cash, I have to provide cash to the government. Where does that come from? I'm being paid in grains and pigs.
Yeah, and your cash is whiskey. So here's your jug of whiskey. I get to keep two jugs, and the government gets one jug. The National Whiskey Dispensary.
I mean, maybe that would have worked better. I don't know. But, you know, it's interesting because it sounds like the maybe some issues in the U.S. tax policy to date still are reminiscent of this, right? Like the big guys produce enough that they can find ways out of taxes. It's really the little producers, the small businesses that get hit the hardest.
Oh yeah. When you got like your Amazons and your Googles and all that pay zero taxes in the United States, and you know, us as middle class America have to pay thousands and thousands of dollars. How is that fair?
Yeah. You know, this is anecdotal, but I there was somebody made a comic out of this that was circulating on the internet, but that, you know, when like a big box store will ask you to like round up your sales to make a donation to a charity, and who's going to say no to that? You would be a monster to say no to that. But then they're taking money from you, and then they're putting that as a donation that shows as a charitable cause that reduces their taxes. And I was like, oh man, they got me.
Yeah. Yes, somebody gets to claim it, so they're going to now.
Yeah,
isn't that nice of them? Yeah.
Gee, thanks, Hamilton. Look, there's a whole musical espousing the greatness of Hamilton. I think I can raise an eyebrow at his tax policy right there.
Well, and the other thing is, too, of course, the Revolutionary War was still fresh in everybody's mind, And here was a tax that came along, and it was the first domestic tax. All the other tax were on imports. Now they do their first domestic tax that the government said, now we're going to tax you. And a lot of people, oh, this is just like the British being back in charge again. Mm. So they weren't over that yet, where that wasn't to them. Even though they were in Philadelphia, which was, you know, the capital at the time, that was not where they were at. And that was those guys over there, taxation without representation. They might be Americans, but they're not me. They don't represent me. I don't want to pay this tax. So they felt very, very revolutionary again.
And indeed they did. When this law was passed, it was met with immediate protest, non-compliance, no one would pay it, and of course, eventual violence. The first documented incidents of attack was on a tax collector on September 11, 1791. There was an excise officer by the name of Robert Johnson who was attacked by a group of men. He was stripped naked and tarred and feathered and abandoned in the woods. So it's pretty bad.
But some kid comes running in, Mama, I just saw a big chicken running through the yard.
I thought tarred and feathered, is this the thing that really happens? Does it kill you? I guess it doesn't, because Johnson was angry, but he recognized some of his attackers. He, you know, had warrants issued for their arrest. And so they sent someone to go call in these warrants, and that person was also attacked and tied up in the woods and abandoned. So at that point, Johnson, the original tax collector, just resigned. F this job.
I've had enough of this. This was the birds. I'm out of here.
Well, so it worked. So that was the sort of modus operandi for this young rebellion in its early stages. They just continued to have attack on excise officers, you know, refuse to pay, resist. Western PA kind of had a loose assembly form at this point. So they could both better express their concerns, you know, they have representation in Congress, but also so if they needed a rebellion, they were ready to go, which they will eventually.
Yeah.
But the things really, the kind of the kickoff event, sort of, it centers around a federal marshal by the name of David Lennox. And this brings us up to 1794, which is the year where the Whiskey Rebellion kicks off. So Federal Marshal David Lennox was tasked with serving 60 distilleries in Western PA writs for not paying their taxes. He was assisted by a local wealthy landowner and tax collector, John Neville. They went farm to farm issuing their summons. They were largely met with compliance, but, eventually word got around that they were going to arrest people for tax evasion or for resistance. So an angry, maybe drunk mob came to greet the collector and the marshal. And while they managed to kind of talk their way out of a direct confrontation on the spot, the next morning, John Neville, whose homestead bore the name of Bower Hill, was awakened by a crowd of angry men who refused to leave his property on his command. So he shot into the crowd and he killed a man by the name of Oliver Miller. That ensuing confrontation, the confrontation that ensued from there, Neville hid. He forced his slaves to fend off the mob. They eventually left, but they would only reconvene to plot their revenge for the death of one of their own. So it's really the sort of incendiary event that leads to the Whiskey Rebellion. So the next day, July 17th, 1794, nearly 700 men arrived at Bower Hill to demand Deville's surrender. The man himself had already run away. He'd hidden in like a...
He slipped out the back door.
Oh, yeah, yeah. He like, lined up all these soldiers that were going to valiantly defend him, and then he just peaced out.
He started singing, "Give Me Three Steps."
There you go. Which is pretty cowardly, because there was gunfighting and death. The mob eventually burned down all of the Bower Hill estate, and anybody that resisted them did surrender. So they might not have gotten the man they were looking for, but they did completely incinerate his property.
And these guys, they were not just a bunch of, you know, drunk rebel rousers out there doing it. They had actually, they'd gone to like Pittsburgh, which was, of course, in the western part of the state and the surrounding counties, and had representatives. And they kind of met in their own type of quasi-governmental discussions of how are we going to handle this?
Yeah.
And they had some that were more moderate and some that were more aggressive. And the moderates won out the first time and said, look, we're going to have to work our way through this. Yes, we don't like it, but we don't want violence. Well, those moderates didn't show up the second time they met in Pittsburgh. So the aggressive ones, they kind of won out and they were like, hell with it. We're not going to take this. We're going to fight. So that was when that started coming back. When the moderates came out, they said, damn, we knew we should have gone to that meeting.
Well, whatever would have been the best path, they found response with their violence, and they were warned at this point after they burned Bower Hill. They were warned that if they did not disband, they'd be met with the militia from Washington, President Washington. Not Capitol Washington. She said not the Capitol yet. Sorry, that was confusing.
Washington the man.
Washington the man.
Pop the man or pop the drink. Yeah. We used to have that.
We called our grandfather Pop. They were not intimidated, but they were instead sort of spurred to action by this threat. And so by this time, the mob had grown to nearly 7,000, and they directed their rage towards Pittsburgh. Because they'd discovered three letters of disapproval of their antics that had been sent from there. So they decided to march on Pittsburgh because somebody in Pittsburgh didn't like what they were doing.
Yeah, they actually confiscated the U.S. mail to read it to see if anybody was saying anything bad about them. I mean, this was pre-social media, but they got some bad comments. Somebody didn't like their Facebook page, so they decided to march on Pittsburgh. And, and they had some real interesting discussions about what they were going to do. Like, now, are we just going to march through there mad? Are we going to march through and maybe shoot off a few guns? Are we going to march through and maybe give people the finger and yell some bad names? You know, they were all these choices they were trying to figure out. Just how exactly what do we want to do here?
Well, I love that idea applied to social media. It's like, hey, you right now that's thinking about writing that bad iTunes review, I might show up at your door. Say, what now? Maybe I'll show up with the like other people that like the show and be like, what now? So think again. Yeah, so they assembled outside of the city in an area known as Braddock's Field. Now, at this point, there were the group that was the 7,000 people. There were distillers among them, small distillers or small producers, rather. But it was also just a lot of poor people, a lot of people that felt like they hadn't been properly cared for by the government.
And it was a Friday night. They had nothing else going on.
You know, but they, I like, you know, some of the talk of like, because we're talking to like, you know, era of the French Revolution. So kind of getting kicked around while they're trying to figure out what to do is also like, I don't know, the French Revolution was a good idea. Do we get some guillotines? Maybe we have another revolution and we join up with Spain. Maybe we go back to Great Britain. Like there was some, you know, propositions here that were interesting. But ultimately, they didn't move forward on anything because Pittsburgh, in fear, claimed that they had expelled, they had located and kicked out the three letter writers. So we're good now.
The three guys that gave them bad reviews, bad Yelp reviews, and they got rid of them.
and they gave the mob barrels of whiskey as an appeasement.
So they got drunk and didn't bother storming the Bastille.
No, but they did march through the streets of Pittsburgh peacefully. So they just had a little parade, a little drunken parade. Have you ever, there's an area outside of Pittsburgh, Monongahela. I always want to say Monongalia, but that's in West Virginia.
Right.
But that's, it's
Monongahela.
Monongahela. It's called Whiskey Point, and that is established because afterwards the Whiskey Rebellion leaders met to discuss their next move there after their successful march through Pittsburgh. So just if you've ever been to Whiskey Point, that's where this comes from.
They use the term successful loosely.
I mean, I think it's making a success. I got rid of my haters and I got a bunch of whiskey. That sounds great to me.
But, you know, the other thing about it is you think, why was Pennsylvania, why were they the ones that they kept picking on? And it was just because they're the closest. Uh-huh. It was easier to pick on them, but this was for all the states at the time. But the U.S. government didn't have the resources to send all these people to all these other states to do it. And, you know, also, you know, the guy just show up. Yeah, I'm from Washington and I'm here to collect taxes. And you show up in some of these places, like they said, they couldn't get anyone to go to Kentucky because anybody that went to Kentucky was not going to come back. So they could, everybody, no, Kentucky, no, I draw the line at that. That's it. You're not going down there. Those guys will kill you.
I was curious, like, starting research. It's like, why is this centered in PA? Because when I think whiskey, I mean, there's some good whiskey out of Pennsylvania, absolutely. But I don't think Pennsylvania, when I think whiskey, it's like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
That was what they thought they could contain. They thought they could enforce the taxes right there because the capital is there, and here are these people they're trying to confront. But
right.
Mixed results. So after this, the government decided to act on their promise. Washington tries to send a peaceful envoy first, just to try to, like, talk through, like, hey, but you could pay your taxes. And they're like, no, we're not gonna. So that didn't work. So after that, he amasses a militia of 12,000 men that he's going to send to confront this mob. Now, a couple of interesting notes, though, on this. One thing that I thought was funny was around this time, Alexander Hamilton also appears in the story again. He starts publishing essays in the Philadelphia newspapers to condemn the mob actions, effectively trying to drum up propaganda because he's using a pseudonym. He publishes under the name Tully and is condemning these mob actions. So the early instance of propaganda by Mr. Alexander Hamilton right now.
Yeah. He was like the minister of propaganda at the time.
A little bit. Like, smart guy. He knew what he was doing. But, yeah. And then the other thing I thought was interesting is that people didn't want to join this militia. You know, that it was met with resistance. People refused to join up. A lot of people commiserated with the mob. And Washington actually had to rely on a draft to gather his forces, which led to a lot of anti-draft protests and riots.
Yeah, well, see, the militia, that each state was supposed to have their own militia. So what Washington did was tell all the states, hey, look, you got to send your militia here to help put this down. That will be my army, your militias. Well, they said, that's all well and good, but we don't really have a militia anymore. Since the war was over, everybody went back to farming.
Yep.
So to get their designated militia they were required to have, they had to start drafting people, and people didn't want to be involved, so they ran off. Mm. They had draft dodgers back then.
Yeah.
In the 1700s, you had draft dodgers. I guess they went to Canada. That's where draft dodgers go, I think.
Well, can you imagine being in Kentucky and, like, yeah, go fight these people over the whiskey tax in Pennsylvania? Like, no.
They'd say, hell, I'm on their side.
He eventually managed to amass his troops, but it was after a lot of, that was its own conflict within itself. Like, they marched into Western PA. The leaders of the mob fled. The groups disbanded. It was pretty quickly dispersed. There was no direct confrontation between the militia and the mob. And really, the militia did what they could. They tried to round up possible suspects involved in treasonous behavior. They, like, got the guy that went through the mail to find those three letters. But they charged two people, and both were pardoned. Nobody was punished for this.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, they couldn't really find who was responsible. A lot of them got away. But there was a couple of firsts that took place in that. This was the first and only time that a sitting president led an army somewhere into battle.
Hmm.
That George Washington led the troops into battle. Of course, it wasn't a battle, but he would still lead them.
He was ready.
But that was the first and only time. It was also the first time that federal troops were called out on our own people. Now, you know, really, you can't say the Civil War was. That was part of the country, you know, seceding. So they were basically a separate country at that time. But I knew I had studied about this before on Court Appointed. We had talked about Trump bringing the federal troops in during the protests.
Oh, right. I was going to say, is that still the only? Because
that's the only other time that our nation has unleashed our federal troops on our own people. Was when he brought him in since the Whiskey Rebellion. That was it. Those are the two times in history.
That's fascinating. Well, after they disbanded, this tax would continue to be, frankly, ignored, and you know, not collected by a lot of distillers and farmers until its eventual repeal under President Thomas Jefferson and the Republican Party, who rather liked undoing Hamilton's tax policy. Olympics.
Yeah, so they ran on that as part of their platform, and it was evidently very popular because he got elected.
Well, and it's interesting. Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say there was a lot of, you know, Alexander Hamilton, we like to think about him as a good guy because, you know, our good friend Lin-Manuel Miranda wrote it. And, you know, and it's a very popular show and everything. But the line of thinking was, is that he wanted a military conflict to happen with the federal troops, you know, just basically demoralizing another group that rebelled against us, because it's kind of like the parent. As a parent, you can either have your children respect you or fear you. He thought it was better being in charge of the new nation of children if they feared their own government, because then they wouldn't have any problems the next time that they tried to employ a federal tax. They would follow along because they wouldn't want that unleashed on them. Now, Washington fortunately won out, and he was more of one, he wanted respect. So there were times he could have gone ahead and gone into battle, but he tried to talk it out and reason it out.
Right.
And ultimately, that was what won the day. And so that's why we had respect for our government and our leaders. As a matter of course, that's the way things are generally done, not through fear.
Well, we've had, I don't know, in recent times, we might have tried to reverse that thought. But it isn't.
That's why I couldn't keep a straight face.
Yeah. I think certain people have thought, oh, that's a good idea. Just make them fear me. But, you know, it is. I do think it's interesting that it's held up a lot of times as this first great stress test of a new nation. And, you know, oh, we prove that we can enforce our policy without violent confrontation. However, in practice, nobody, it's like people still ignored it. People still ignored the tax until it was repealed, and then it was done away with. So we got to hold up our grand victory of democracy at work, but it really didn't really work. But we still celebrate the Whiskey Rebellion in Washington, Pennsylvania. They started the Whiskey Rebellion Festival in 2011. This event, it's held in July. They have food and reenactments and live music. And they actually have a reenactment of the tar and feathering of the tax collector.
I wonder if they like have somebody from the city there that they all like, I hope I get to be the guy this year that gets tarred and feathered.
You know? I do hope they pick a political person to do that. I think that's pretty funny.
Yeah, it's like Logan. They do the Aracoma story down there every year at the outdoor amphitheater, because that's took place in Logan's history. And so it's always a big honor for some young woman from the area that gets to be picked to play the part of Aracoma. So I wonder if it's a big honor in Washington, Pennsylvania, you get picked to be the part of the tax collector that gets tarred and feathered.
Maybe. Sounds not cool, but maybe. So not long after we have the repeal of the whiskey tax, something else that's pretty established in Pennsylvania's boozy history is established. I'm talking about Yingling, the Yingling Brewery.
Yeah, a mere 36 years after the Whiskey Rebellion, Yingling establishes itself in Pottsville, Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
Yingling? So some of the people that were at the Whiskey Rebellion could have worked for Yingling.
It seems like probably a better position than, you know, active rebel, just a brewer.
Well, there wasn't a tax on beer, you know, so it was just a tax on whiskey.
Yeah, beer wasn't really considering all that like worrisome at the time. You know, we like liquor was intoxicating. Beer was just food.
Well, the other thing was, too, at the time, they didn't have a good way to transport beer and do things that spoiled. So people, it was easier and, you know, more economical to make whiskey. You could transport that, and it kept longer. As long as you kept the lid on, it would keep.
That's true. Yeah, so Yingling has its roots in 1829. It was established by a German immigrant by the name of David Gottlieb Yingling. So basically, the way we get Yingling, the name, is from just sort of a Americanization of the original founder's last name, German surname, which roughly translates to young man. So, young man beer. But Yingling is just sort of an Americanification of it.
Yeah, I gotta say, the first time I came across Yingling, it wasn't until about, I'm gonna say about 2005, was the first time that I'd ever seen it anywhere. It was in Virginia, and they didn't sell it around here. I was at a trip in Virginia and found it. And Yingling, to me, it sounded Asian. I thought it was some kind of Asian beer that I was getting, like a Japanese beer or something like that. So I got it and I'm drinking it, and I look on their oldest beer in America. How can this be the oldest beer in America and I've never heard of it?
It's originally roots in Germany. And I mean, that makes sense because, you know, a lot of, especially when we're talking about like really a lot of style beers, but we get from a lot of German brewers brought their crafts to America, and that's where we got. Mm-hmm. A lot of the classic style of American Pilsners are rooted in German brewing techniques. So the Germans really brought their A game to the bedrock or the establishment of American brewing, and no different with Yingling. So David Yingling set up he first called his brewery the Eagle Brewery. Like Dad mentioned, it's located in Pottsville. One of his sons, it's a family business, it always has been, but one of his sons actually branched off and went down to Virginia to form the James River Steam Brewery, producing steam beer, which is a whole other thing. We should come back to that for another episode. But so if you ever heard of that brewery, that's also related to Yingling.
The popular steam beer category, which you've heard so much about.
Have you ever had an Anchor Steam?
Yeah, I have had an Anchor Steam.
Yeah,
steam but that's beer. The only steam beer I can think of.
There are a couple out there. I think I like steam beer, but it is its own thing. But we're not talking about steam beer. Not now.
No, but I thought that was interesting that he left his father's business that became immensely successful to go into steam beer.
Well, he had a vision, you know. Yeah, and they definitely weren't making steam beers at Yingling. They were making, probably initially, it was largely just ales and porters. That was the style mm-hmm. that was popular at the time. The quintessential amber ale that we think of when we think of Yingling, that wouldn't arrive for a while longer. We'll get to that. So the Eagle Brewery had a fire in 1831. They relocated to the spot that they are currently still at, still in Pottsville. And after that, they changed their name. Yingling's son, Frank, joined ownership, and so they renamed it to D.G. Yingling and Son in 1873.
But they still kept their eagle emblem on the labels that they had from their original Eagle Distributing.
And that's still iconic of Yingling. One thing that I think is standout about Yingling in history is the actions they took to survive Prohibition. This was under the guidance of the son, Frank Yingling. So they survived Prohibition a couple of ways. First was by producing near beer, which was beer that was brewed just below the legal alcohol that you could have in a beer. So it had like a little bit of alcohol in it, but you could call it non-alcoholic, basically.
Just like what is the one now that's so popular?
Beck's?
Is it Beck's?
Not Beck's. No. O'Doul's.
O'Doul's, yeah.
Sorry, Beck's. That one. You taste like you don't have alcohol, but no.
I guess it tastes like beer, but it tastes like beer with no alcohol, so.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to get into the argument of, like, what's the point of beer without alcohol? I like the taste of some beer, but when we're talking about, like, super light lagery beers, I don't see the point. But, whatever. It was a mode of survival during Prohibition. They also made ice cream. They had a dairy that they owned, so they made ice cream in the Yingling label. And I thought this was cool. They ran dance halls in Pennsylvania and also in New York City. They actually are responsible for the Roseland Ballroom, which is still there to this day.
Yeah. They expanded out into several things there.
They just kind of like, whatever we can do to stay alive during this time period, we are going to do. And that was really unique for a lot of, a lot of breweries went out of business during Prohibition or tried to rely on just one thing. Yingling definitely differentiated their portfolio. In 1933, in celebration of Repeal Day, of course, they brewed a beer they called Winter Beer. Winter.
Winner!
Yes.
Just like Charlie Sheen.
There we go.
Winning.
There's a winning beer. It was Winter Beer. They shipped a truckload to President Roosevelt himself. So.
And he took it gratefully.
Yeah.
And he loved it. And it was also Barack Obama's favorite beer.
It was. Barack Obama was a big fan. He actually, there's a story that's he lost a hockey bet, I believe, with the PM at the time of Canada. So he was he had to send them a case of Molson, but he sent along with it a case of Yingling. And now that case of Yingling is like in the Hockey Hall of Fame or museum or something. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Has some deep histories in presidents, which maybe some more in modern times, but just to round out the history. So they passed hands, stayed within the Yingling family throughout time. They had a boost in sales in 1976 to celebrate America's anniversary, of course, bicentennial. And in the next decades, they would be legally recognized as America's oldest brewery and a protected historical place. So those are big designations for them. Now, it wasn't until 1987 that the Yingling Lager, which we all know, reappeared. And it was basically to just kind of match the popular styles of the time. So that's when that beer that is now the flagship came about. And now it accounts for 80% of their sales. By the early 1990s, they couldn't keep up for demands on their flagship product. They had a very restricted selling area. It was available in like Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware. So they decided to expand their operation so they could service more of the East Coast. They opened a brewery in Tampa, Florida, and Port Carbon in PA. So one more distillery in PA, then down to Florida.
Yeah, it was an abandoned Stroh's brewery in Florida that they took over.
Yeah. And that, you know, it's funny because I remember this. I started college in 2004, and it was a big deal in New York to be able to get Yingling still. I'd never had Yingling, of course, in West Virginia, but even in New York, it was newly available. And that was the cool beer to drink my freshman year.
Yeah, it was only available like in 15 different states there for quite a while. I think they've expanded to 22.
Yeah.
But they kept it really just right here within the area.
Yeah. And that's not uncommon, especially for all spirits. But, you know, you kind of have to get allowance to exist in each state's marketplace. And so you get this.
I remember the very first Coors I drank, it was imported from Mexico.
Really?
Yeah, because they didn't sell it east of the Mississippi.
Oh.
And so the only way you could get it is it went to Mexico as an import beer down there. And then in the eastern part of the United States would buy it back from Mexico as an import beer.
That's interesting. Well, that's back in my first job in the city. I worked at a beer bar and we would, it was like a 20 tap beer bar, but we would get pirated kegs of beer that wasn't allowed to be sold in the New York area and like release it on like a secret beer newsletter that people could come in and have this beer. But we were aware that if cops ever showed up, we would pretend that we didn't ever see that beer and that beer never existed here. We'd never heard of that beer.
We've never heard of it.
The big one was, this was before Bell's was allowed to be sold in New York. And so the Bell's Brewery, there were a lot of kegs of Bell's that would come through that we were all supposed to be very excited about hosting, but then also put us all in possible contempt of the law. Now Yingling has massively, because of their expanded operations, they've expanded throughout the East Coast. And that's all cool. You know, you look at the history of Yingling, it's family owned, it's passed down from generation to generation of Yinglings. That's cool. Founded by immigrants. That's cool. But before you turn off this podcast and run out and buy a case of Yingling in celebration of America's history, I do think that there are some facts about the current owner of Yingling, the fifth generation owner, aptly named, I think, Dick Yingling, might make you think different. So let's get into some, they've had some recent controversies. Now, the big one, of course, that I think made it up to mainstream news is that they endorsed President Trump in 2016. They gave Eric Trump a tour of the brewery. They came out as pro-Trump. The owner said, you know, we survived prohibition. We can survive your boycotts. We don't care. And that's however you feel about politics. Outside of the Trump Association, there's also some other stuff that's pretty unfortunate about the recent incarnation of Yingling. They've had a lot of back and forth with labor unions. Dick Yingling, He threatened to close the Pottsville Brewery if union workers didn't decertify their union. And this was inspired because the labor board had awarded back pay to several employees who were laid off simply for their seniority. So because they did this in retaliation, he pressured his employees to decertify their union.
And this is in Pennsylvania, which is a strong union state, and Yingling with a history of most of their beer sales going to coal miners that worked in the area.
Exactly.
So, and coal mines, of course, are heavily unionized. So this went against everything that the city valued.
And it was a bad situation for everybody involved, because the workers, while they did not, many had come forward with this information to try to reach out to news sources, and you know, their union was trying to speak on their behalf, but also in Pottsville, it's kind of one of the biggest employers, you know, that they would, this is some of the only game in town as far as employment goes. So they couldn't really comfortably come forward and stand up for themselves with the threat of losing maybe the only job they could find. So,
right. And lots of other local industries were tied to them as well. So if they went, there was a lot of things that fell by the wayside.
Yeah. So he got his way. Continues to have sort of shitty things to say about the existence of unions. And, you know, if that doesn't bother you, let's talk a little bit about, I don't know, how about the environment? They have consistently violated the Clean Water Act. And I guess it's just sort of, we'd rather pay the fines than fix the problem. So they're pretty bad in the pollution department. And they also have a reported like over $6 million in unpaid taxes accredited to the Yingling family.
Yeah, they were dumping polluted water into the Schuylkill River, which supplied 85% of the drinking water for the towns around there. And it had been so polluted at one time, they had to get all the industries that in the area together and say, look, you've got to not be dumping in here because we're all going to have problems with this. So everybody complied except Yingling. Mm-hmm. Yingling just said, look, this is what we're going to do. If you don't like it, fine us.
Well, and you know, outside of that, they continue to be named the number one craft distillery in America, or craft brewery in America. But that's, I mean, when we talk about craft beer, what that brings to mind, a small production, you know, like handmade, they really just get that designation because in 2013, a lot of the stipulations for how to be considered a craft brewery were done away with, an ingredient list and, you know, like how it's made. And that was partially because of a lot of craft breweries coming together along with Yingling to try to separate themselves from the bigger companies. And while that sort of union fell apart, the benefactor of that was Yingling, because now they could be considered a craft brewery, but nothing changed as far as the protection of craft breweries. So they continue to get the designation to the ire, I think, of a lot of successful more
craft
hands-on
brewers.
Yeah. I mean, at this point, it's just how much you sell. Like, if you sell less than, 6 million cases, you're craft.
Yeah.
So that's, most craft breweries don't even begin to get there. So it's a bummer because I think it's a great American success story, right? Immigrant founded, passed down through the family.
And it is a good beer. They do make good beer. Oh, I do. I like it.
I will say this. If you like Yingling, I think if anything, any of the facts we've shared with you about Yingling bother you, I would say that there are some other excellent amber lagers out there. The Bell's Brewery has one that I mentioned. Fat Tire is, I think that's an amber ale though, right?
That's a Belgium white.
No, that's what we had on the episode, but Fat Tire has a different one.
They have a different one. Yeah. You're right. They have several versions.
Yeah. But there are the same style of beer out there that you could check out, you know. And there's also a lot of other really cool smaller craft breweries in mm-hmm. PA. Trogs is located there. Victory is located there. So, you know.
But now I do have some hope there for Yingling to turn the corner on some of those things, because Dick is getting on up in age. So I don't think that I'm not sure that he's still running the place. What I understand, he's had four daughters.
Right.
And his four daughters all work there, and one of them is actually running it. Now, the daughters were instrumental in, they had quit making the ice cream, of course, sometime after Prohibition. They've brought that back, and they're making their ice cream again, which ice cream kind of imitates their beer. Like, they have a black and tan beer, and they have a black and tan ice cream. But, of course, it's not a beer-flavored ice cream.
Right.
It's just is a takeoff on that. But I would like to think that they will probably be more socially conscious than Dick.
I hope so. I hope so. Because it's something that I think Pennsylvania has. Well, I was going to say Pennsylvania has been proud of for a long time. But clearly in more recent decades, they've had some problems with. So, yeah. Where to go from there? I hate ending on a downer. I don't know. Where do I go from there?
Hey, we're just telling it like it is. We're not making it. It's not good and it's not bad. That's just what. Here's all the good things about them, and here's some things that might be questionable. Draw your own conclusion. We're not trying to influence you.
Well,
I'll still drink a Yingling, especially if it's on tap. I like it a lot better draft than I do out of the bottle.
I think knowing about how they've operated recently, I will reach for a different, I would argue, better beer. But you know.
But now I want to try out their Hershey chocolate porter. They have that as a new offering, and I got to try that out just to see if it's any good. Yeah, well, which
right.
of course Hershey is Hershey, PA.
Yeah.
And so they've gotten together with them, and they've come out with a Hershey's chocolate porter by Yingling. So I've got to try that anyway. I mean, maybe that makes me a communist. I don't know, but I got to try it.
No, I don't think that makes you a communist. I think it's worried about being associated with being a fascist.
Oh, okay.
I think that's what we're going to worry about there.
Thanks a lot, Dick. Now I can't drink the beers I want, Dick.
I think that's the right attitude. I don't. I'm going to police your attitude, but yeah, I don't know. I. All right. So for better, and then for worse, that's the history of Yingling. Maybe with a whole bunch of daughters, the company will find some redemption, find some better labor practices, some better environmental practices, some better support for their local community and existence within the craft world. But
and pay their damn taxes.
And pay your damn taxes.
Well, no wonder they back up Donald Trump. They're just like him.
I know, right? Like, I've been paying taxes since I worked at the mall food court when I was, 19? Between sessions of college in the summer, I have never paid less than arbitrary number $750 on my taxes. I've always paid more than that.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. So, hey, Yingling, you could pay your taxes.
Yeah, and you can't pay it in whiskey. They don't take that for barter.
Well, and you know, I bet these small small breweries in PA are paying their taxes, but they're not finding ways around it. So,
yeah, little guys don't have much wiggle room. I own a small business. I know that.
Yeah. So maybe seek out some other small breweries in PA to try some of PA's best beers.
And if you find a good one, tell us about it, and maybe we can do an episode on it.
Yeah. I think there's definitely, I've mentioned a few, but there's definitely better beers in PA. All right. Well, this has been your little rundown of some Pennsylvania boozy history. You got a rebellion, you've got world's oldest brewery. There's some stuff there, makes sense.
And you got Dick.
I'm sorry about that. But in all seriousness, thank you to everybody that voted in this presidential election. It's ultimately the power of the people. It's the greatest nonviolent means of change we have in this country. And ultimately, the vote count is what decides it. It's not about, you know, what politicians say. It comes down to our power, and I think we showed out in amazing numbers in this presidential election. So kudos to all of you, but I'm giving a specific shout out to those of you in Pennsylvania, just because you came through in the clutch.
Our democracy is what makes us great, not our power.
I agree, and I think it is better to be respected than feared. So
I agree.
Let's get back to that.
That's right. Let's make some respectful beer.
All right. So over on the video, I will be maybe trying out some other beers from PA just to give you some options. We'll be making some cocktails, and I don't know. Dad had a good idea for a drink that I'm excited as a mixer. Another non-alcoholic thing that Pennsylvania is known for is birch beer, right, Dad?
That's right. Birch beer from a particular kind of sap that grows from some trees that are found in the Northeast and down through the Appalachian Mountains.
Right. So, I mean, that's a cool thing to bring in. Also for you non-drinkers out there, so you can sort of play along at home. And we'll make up some PA-inspired drinks. All right.
There we go. Yeah. Maybe something named the Punxsutawney Phil.
Yeah.
You drink it, and the next morning you wake up and can't see your shadow.
I'm going to make a drink called the Flipadelphia.
The Red Mirage.
Yeah. The Red Mirage and the Blue Wave. Ooh, that was a long mirage. That was a 4-day. I was not expecting 4 days of that. It felt like 4 days. It was about that, right? Yeah.
I don't know. In the pandemic, it could have been 4 years. Who knows?
Yeah. If March can last for a year, Tuesday can at least last for a week.
That's true.
All right. A little bit of housekeeping. Of course, you can find us on on YouTube at Neat the Boozecast, on Twitter, on Instagram at Neat Boozecast. Please follow us. Please tweet at us if you have questions, thoughts about episodes. If you would like to support us, we have a Patreon, Neat the Boozecast. If you join, you get stickers, you get coasters, you get sometimes some special Patreon-only content, and of course, our undying love and appreciation.
Yeah, that's right. We appreciate you.
Yes. Thank you to all of our Patreons and to all of our listeners, all of our watchers. Thank you for being here. And I have been Taylor Smurl.
I have been Tommy Smurl.
And this has been
Neat. With you, huh?